The Gateway brings you the day's news from the St. Louis region and across Missouri. It also includes stories from the Illinois side of the river and our Metro East reporter, Will Bauer.
In Alton, in Belleville, in East St. Louis, in Edwardsville, in Cahokia Heights, at Scott Air Force Base, I'm Will Bauer, St. Louis Public Radio.
Listen to reports from Will and all of our journalists weekdays on The Gateway, on the STLPR app, and wherever you get podcasts.
From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
The Missouri legislature has reached the halfway mark of the 2024 legislative session. Members of the House have passed 36 pieces of legislation out of its chamber, while the Missouri Senate has passed 13. One of the bills passed by the Senate is an omnibus bill centered on public safety. A similar bill was vetoed last year by Governor Mike Parson. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Senator Tony Lueckdemeyer joins the show. The Platte Republican talks about his public safety bill, including what changes he made in order to get Parson's signature this time around. He also spoke on other legislation he's sponsored this year, including a bill that would legalize sports betting. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
My promise to St. Louis was that I would do the absolute most for each and every person, starting with those who have the very least.
What I wanted to do was look and see what other states are doing.
We have to be willing to change those laws, that they are balanced and they affect everybody equally.
As somebody that grew up in the St. Louis area, in North St. Louis County, I didn't know any lawyers growing up.
We got to find long-term solutions to make government better, but also to be able to provide services to people.
I don't want to leave that federal money that we've been leaving all these years on the table.
We need to be spending this money to take care of Missourians.
I thought we accomplished a lot this year, but a lot more needs to be done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, State House and Politics reporter Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in Jefferson City in our little studio attic office here, he is the senator for the 34th District in the Missouri Senate.
Tony Lueckdemeyer.
Thank you so much for joining us. We have a lot of topics to get into. But before we get into kind of the minutiae of that, just remind our listeners like who you are, who you represent, what your district looks like.
Yeah, so I represent the 34th Senatorial District, which is Platte and Buchanan County. So it's the northern portions of Kansas City that sit north of the Missouri River all the way up to St. Joseph. So those are my two main population centers, is St. Joe and then Kansas City.
All right, let's get into it. So the Senate has passed a pretty big omnibus public safety bill that was kind of your baby. It passed last year, but ultimately was vetoed. Kind of give a brief overview of it before we get into some of the specifics.
Yeah, so 189 was a bill that I sponsored last year. As you mentioned, was vetoed by the governor. He had a couple of different objections. Principally, though, we had a provision in there that would have entitled people who were wrongfully convicted to be able to get restitution from the state. I think there was a feeling from the governor's office that money should come from local prosecutors as opposed to the state, since local prosecutors handle those prosecutions. And so the reset, as if you will, of the bill this year, Senate Bill 754, still we're early enough in session where I'm still trying to remember all the bill numbers. So 754, which I filed this year, is basically a redo of Senate Bill 189, removing the provisions that the governor objected to in his veto message, and then trying to hit the reset button to see if we can get some of those things done.
Yeah, kind of on the veto, do you agree with Parson's sentiment on that?
I don't. Frankly, the way that criminal prosecutions work in Missouri, if a criminal case were filed against you, it would be state of Missouri versus Kellogg. Right. So even though a county prosecutor is a county elected official, they're prosecuting criminal cases on behalf of the state of Missouri. So they're acting as an agent of the state. Circuit judges who are enforcing those criminal penalties also acting as agents of the state of Missouri. Of course, when somebody's incarcerated wrongfully, they're in the Department of Corrections, which is a state agency that reports to the governor. So my view is, whether it's a county elected official that's bringing the prosecution or not, this is a state issue. And if somebody is wrongfully convicted and they have their life, taken away from them wrongfully by the state for decades, and in some cases, they should be entitled to some restitution for that. I think most people, even your most law and order individual out there would agree with that sentiment. Somebody who's wrongfully incarcerated should be compensated for that time that they spent in prison.
Yeah, I went to that hearing on that particular portion last year, and really, I just felt a lot of empathy coming from every single senator, didn't matter if they were Democratic or Republican. Yeah. And do you think this is something that you maybe see will be passing again, maybe under a different governor?
Yeah, I do think this would be something that we probably bring back to the forefront under a future administration. We kind of got our answer last year when Senate Bill 189 was vetoed. It didn't seem like it would be a smart strategic move to put that back in the bill this year again. And so that's why it's out for this session.
You know, with this omnibus bill that has passed, there was a lot of bipartisan buy-in. Do you find this normal for a lot of kind of the larger bills that go through?
Yeah, it kind of varies from bill to bill. Like today, for example, I know we're going to talk about this later, the education reform bill. It was largely a partisan vote. In fact, I think every no vote, every Democrat voted no on it. And then most Republicans voted yes for it, even though that was a compromise package from Senator Koenig that had a lot of things in it that probably make the Democrats pretty happy. That's why we didn't see an extended filibuster on that bill. But, you know, when I've, you know, worked on big pieces of legislation like this, one of the things I try to do is to get bipartisan buy-in. When you're dealing with criminal justice reform, those tend to be some of the more tense topics that we debate in the General Assembly. And so having some level of bipartisan support, I think, is pretty critical to get a bill like that through the General Assembly.
So for our listeners, we're going to get into some of the specifics, but kind of give like a highlights of this omnibus, some of the things that you really want to kind of highlight and talk about, and we'll probably get into a lot of those.
Yeah. So the main provision, which is actually the original filed bill, is a bill called Max's Law. And this is something that's kind of near and dear to my heart. 3 years ago, we had a police canine up in St. Joseph that was shot and killed in the line of duty. He and his human partner were trying to serve a domestic assault warrant on a dangerous individual, and this person ended up shooting and killing the dog. So as it stands under current Missouri law right now, the penalty for killing a law enforcement canine is treated as low-level property damage. And in fact, it is a more serious penalty under Missouri law right now to break the window out of a police cruiser, which is admittedly a serious crime, than it is to kill a law enforcement canine. So what Max's Law does is it increases the penalty for injuring or killing a law enforcement canine to a felony, the impact of which is that if somebody was convicted of that crime, they could spend time in prison. And so this bill really just recognizes the tremendous sacrifice that these animals make to keep both their human partners and the public at large safe. These animals are also very expensive to train. You know, we had testimony from a lot of area law enforcement agencies. You know, these dogs cost about $15,000. So even if you just look at it from a pure property damage perspective, these are very expensive, quote unquote, pieces of property. And so, I was really happy to see that we were able to navigate that bill back through the process. One of the other provisions that's in the bill is known as Blair's Law. So Blair's Law is named after a young girl from the Kansas City area who was killed tragically on the 4th of July because of celebratory gunfire. This is when, you know, people during the 4th or, you know, during, the new year will just indiscriminately fire bullets up in the air, live rounds of ammunition. And sometimes they will come down and they will hit an individual. Well, because the person's not intending to kill somebody, you can't really bring a homicide charge against them. And so Blair's Law is intended to kind of fill that gap in the law by creating a separate penalty for somebody who engages in celebratory gunfire that results in the injury or death of an individual. And then the last provision, and again, there are other things in the bill, I'm just kind of doing the kind of the highlights, was actually not in Senate Bill 189 this year, but we put it into the reset bill this year. And that is a provision that's known as Valentine's Law. So it's named after a St. Louis County police officer who was killed in the line of duty during a high-speed chase. We see these from time to time where you have an individual, oftentimes who's dangerous, who is fleeing from law enforcement, and it poses a huge risk of public safety, not only to the officer who's pursuing them, but also the public at large, you know, because oftentimes these involve fatal car accidents and you know, a lot of different tragic things. And so that law creates a separate penalty of fleeing from law enforcement, and it's named in honor of Officer Valentine.
So it's fun. You mentioned all three that I have follow-up questions on. You're reading my mind. So let's start with Max's Law. Sure. There is a sliding scale with the penalties on how injured the dog is, whether or not it needs veterinary care or up to killing the dog or whatever police animal it would be. Thoughts on like why you have that sliding scale?
Yeah. So I think it's, well, first of all, the way that it works is it's a Class A misdemeanor under Max's Law to injure a law enforcement animal. If you injure the law enforcement animal seriously, which we define under the act as requiring veterinary care, then it bumps up to a class E felony, which is the lowest level felony. If the animal is killed, it's a class D. And I think, you know, really what that's designed to do is it's the severity of the crime. You know, injuring an animal to the point where they don't require veterinary care is less serious than killing an animal. And we see this all over our criminal code. You know, somebody who commits some low level assault on another person is guilty of a lower level felony. Whereas if somebody commits a homicide, it's a much heftier penalty that's associated with it. And so that's the same logic that applies to this bill as well.
There were some concerns from members of the Freedom Caucus over the section self-defense being a point that was brought up. What do you make of this argument?
I don't buy the argument. You know, at the end of the day, you know, any defense that you would have to any crime, whether that's self-defense or any other affirmative defense under the criminal code, you can assert that to any crime, whether it's homicide, whether it's Max's law. So all of those things would still be available. Again, this is intended to deal with circumstances where an individual who's dangerous is, you know, being apprehended partially through the use of one of these canine officers. And in those circumstances, they have no right to self-defense. And so, you know, if they want to shoot and kill or injure a police dog, we just want to make sure that they're held accountable.
To go back to Blair's law, you know, this one is pretty important to the Kansas City area. It's actually been, you know, carried by Democrats, too. Like, what do you think bridges the divide on this so that Republicans and Democrats can agree on this particular concept?
Well, you know, I mean, obviously, when it comes to any gun related legislation, that's obviously a sensitive topic, you know, between Democrats and Republicans here in Jefferson City. One thing that I think there's universal agreement on is that, you know, somebody who's just indiscriminately shooting bullets up into the air, they're not acting as a responsible gun owner, where they're acting recklessly with criminal recklessness, and that people should be held accountable for that. And so that's why I think you see a lot of bipartisanship surrounding this. You know, for example, Senator Schroer, who's a member of the Freedom Caucus, when he was in the House, he actually carried and sponsored Blair's law for a number of years. You know, this year, Senator Razor was the principal sponsor over in the Senate, a Democrat from Kansas City. So, you know, this is just an area where I think people feel it's fairly common sense and straightforward that if you just start spraying bullets up in the air and they hurt somebody, you should be held accountable for that in a court of law.
Before we move on to the Valentine's law, is there any other form of like common sense things that you think that lawmakers can come together on when it comes to like gun control?
So I don't know that I would use the phrase gun control.
Fair enough.
Yeah. Firearms related legislation. So we actually have some other provisions that are in the bill that we just passed, one of which increases the penalties for unlawful transfer of a firearm to a minor. So this would be like without parental consent, someone transfers a firearm to a minor, encourages them to commit a crime with it. We've increased the penalties for that. And we actually see that a lot in areas like St. Louis and Kansas City, where there'll be somebody who is not the child's parent and they will give them a weapon, encourage them to do, you know, commit some criminal act with it. And this enhances the penalties for that type of conduct to hold those folks accountable. The other provision that we put in there is an enhancement to the state's so-called unlawful possession of a firearm. So that's the state equivalent of, at the federal level, what's known as felon in possession. So if you are a convicted felon, you cannot own a firearm. You cannot possess a firearm. And the criminal penalties at the federal level are way more stringent than they are at the state level. And as a consequence of that, most federal possession cases that involve a felon with a firearm are prosecuted federally. They're not prosecuted at the state level. And so one of the hopefully impacts of that legislation is by increasing the penalty to bring it more in line with federal standards, we will start to see more aggressive prosecution of felon in possession cases at the state level in Missouri.
On Valentine's law, the House is working on its own version of the bill, and it actually, through the House perfection process, it actually added an exception to this where if someone isn't speeding, which they defined as 10 miles or over or more, but they're basically continuing to drive so they can find somewhere safe to pull over that's either better on the highway or well lit, you know, that would not be basically considered fleeing. Would you support that revision?
So I'm going to be very careful in the way I answer that because it's going to be, and this is kind of inside baseball, the Senate has been fairly slow to act on things this legislative session. I think we've now at this point going into the spring break, maybe passed 10 Senate bills that are over in the House. So anytime there's an amendment that gets offered to a Senate bill, it has to come back to the Senate again. And so I'm very hesitant to say that I would, you know, welcome any type of amendment to a Senate bill that's over in the House, because the likelihood of that bill being able to make it back through the process would be very difficult. The other comment that I would make, without, you know, having reviewed the language that you just referenced, is that, you know, oftentimes, and we see this in the Senate too, and I know it happens in the House, there will be floor debate about these hypotheticals. Well, what if this were to happen? And the reality is, you cannot write a statute that can come up with every possible hypothetical, and you have to trust local prosecutors to make accurate prosecutorial decisions, to exercise good prosecutorial discretion. My guess is, if somebody were trying to pull over to the side of the road, a prosecutor's not going to prosecute them under this law. So is that theoretically possible? Sure. Is it probable? No, it's not.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back.
If you have a smart speaker, you have access to the entire world of NPR and St. Louis Public Radio. All the latest news and all the captivating stories. Activate our voices with yours by telling your smart speaker to play St. Louis Public Radio.
And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Senator Tony Lueckmeyer, who is the senator for the 34th District in the Senate, which includes Platt County. Let's get back into it. We have a different set of questions now, but still on your legislation a little bit. I want to get to another bill that you've sponsored, which is a fix to a bill that gives tax relief to seniors. First, I would love for you to talk about the original bill.
Yeah, so the original bill, which we passed last year and was signed into law by the governor, was Senate Bill 190. And I sponsored this legislation really as a reaction to a lot of feedback that I was getting from constituents in the year prior. We had seen in the Kansas City area, I know certainly this is true in St. Louis and other parts of the state, these dramatic increases to real estate property assessments. And in some cases, you know, a property tax assessment will go up by 50-60+% in a single assessment cycle. And so this has a huge impact on seniors. You know, most of our seniors in Missouri are on fixed incomes. They're retired. And so when their property taxes go up dramatically on their home, they don't have the ability to just go out and get another job and supplement their income and figure out how to make that work. And so what we've been seeing around the state, particularly in some of the metropolitan areas where real estate values have been skyrocketing, is people are in the position of being taxed out of their home by local government. I think that most of your listeners would agree that's not appropriate, regardless of which side of the political spectrum you sit on. So I passed Senate Bill 199 in response to that. And what it did is it said anybody who qualifies for Social Security benefits, that they are exempt from any future increases to their property taxes if the local county adopts an ordinance implementing Senate Bill 190. And so the effect of that was anybody who receive Social Security who is age 62 or older, they would have their property taxes frozen and they would still pay property taxes. But going into the future, they would not see these dramatic increases that would risk evicting them from their home.
Why did there have to be a fix? Tell me kind of like the need for this updated bill.
Yeah. So the bill that I filed this year, one of the things that, you know, we didn't identify until too late in the process to change it, was that there are some individuals who are not eligible for Social Security. So, for example, anybody that's on a public pension, so you think retired school teachers, firefighters, police officers, they don't receive Social Security benefits, but they still, at age 62, qualify as a senior. And so the change that we made in the bill is pretty simple and straightforward. Rather than tying eligibility of the property tax freeze to Social Security eligibility, we instead tied it just to age. So now anyone who's age 62 or older would benefit from the tax freeze that is being implemented under Senate Bill 190.
This has already been passed in St. Louis County, St. Louis City, St. Charles County, just to name a couple areas. You know, what is the feedback that you've been getting so far on this?
Oh, I mean, it's overwhelmingly positive from seniors. I mean, we have probably had more constituents and people around the state reaching out to our office just saying thank you for this piece of legislation than anything that I've sponsored over the last 6 years that I've been in the Senate. And so, you know, it's been very rewarding. You know, when I was campaigning for re-election this last time around, this particular issue, when I would knock on the doors of a senior when I was campaigning, it was the most common issue that came up. And what they would say is they'd say, look, even liberal progressive states like California have restrictions on how much property taxes can go up so that people aren't being taxed out of their homes. And so, you know, surely if California can do something, Missouri can do something to protect seniors. And so that's really where this legislation came from. And it's been very rewarding to get to see the outpouring of support from people around the state.
There was a request from some Democrats for the implementation of a means test for this tax relief. You said you're against that idea. Why?
Yeah, so I'm against that idea. One, I think that, you know, all of our seniors have paid their fair share. You know, by the time they reach age 62, remember that most of the property taxes that you pay on your property tax bill go to the schools. There aren't too many seniors that have kids that are in school still. And so we're not saying that they don't have to pay property taxes to support the schools, to support other local government functions. We're just saying once you reach age 62 and you're at the age of retirement and you're probably shifting to a phase of life where you're on a fixed income, we're just going to freeze your property tax so you have predictability going forward.
One bill that you've heard in your Judiciary Committee is a bill that would raise the minimum age of marriage to 18 in Missouri without any exceptions. Do you think that this has the momentum to pass this session?
You know, we'll see. That's a bill that I'm obviously supportive of. I heard the bill in the Judiciary Committee, voted for it. It's been sponsored by Senator Thompson Rader and also by Senator Arthur. They both have sponsored the same legislation. You know, to me, it's pretty commonsensical. You know, there's a lot of things that we require of people for them to do something, they have to be an adult. And marriage is a pretty serious thing. And so I think requiring people to be 18 or older to be able to enter into the covenant of marriage just makes a lot of sense. And so, you know, I'm supportive of the legislation. I know there have maybe been some issues in the past where we might have a couple of members of the Senate who'd voice some concern over that. You know, I think that the big benefit of this, and this is something we heard in the committee testimony, is that oftentimes child brides are being taken advantage of. There are issues where this is done to further along sex trafficking and a whole host of different crimes against children. And so this is one way that we can make sure we're better protecting our children in Missouri.
Do you think at this point, because we are now, we're recording this literally the Thursday before spring break, do you think that it's now kind of a matter of time as far as momentum more than just ability and agreement in the Senate?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I'm going to be very interested to see what everything looks like after we get back from legislative spring break, because it has been a slow go the first part of the legislative session. We've passed like 10 Senate bills, which is, I mean, a fifth of the number of bills that we probably would have passed in years past when we get to this point in the session. So, you know, time is going to be a major factor, you know, once we get back from legislative spring break in terms of what passes.
You've once again filed legislation this session that would legalize sports betting in Missouri. Last year, your bill made it to the Senate floor, but ultimately died due to the disagreements over the authorization of video lottery machines or gray machines, which are the slot machines, gaming machines you see often in gas stations. Why did you decide to file it again?
To keep the conversation going. You know, sports wagering, it's funny. You know, you have all these niche issues that you work on in the General Assembly, and it garners support from, you know, different, you know, segments of your constituency. I would say every male age 21 through 45, this is their number one issue. Like the number of people that we hear feedback from saying, when are we going to, you know, pass sports wagering, particularly over in Kansas City, you know, in recent years with the Chiefs being so hot, a lot of people want to be able to place a lawful bet on sports wagers. So, you know, right now, every single state that surrounds Missouri has implemented some form of sports wagering. And so the effect of that is we're losing tax revenue that in Missouri is earmarked for education because gaming money has to go to schools. That is now flowing outside of the state of Missouri to Kansas and Illinois and our other border states. And so you see people in Kansas City on Sunday when the Chiefs are playing, driving across the river just so that they can place a sports bet on their mobile app, and they drive right back to Missouri for the game. And the same thing is true over in St. Louis when you see people driving over to Illinois. And so for me, this legislation is about two things. One, making sure that we're keeping those educational tax dollars here in Missouri and not subsidizing the schools of our border states. And secondly, making sure we're setting up a regulated environment where consumers are protected, because we do know that some people bet illegally in the state of Missouri on some, whatever you want to call them, gray market platforms, where it's usually like an offshore company that's not reputable. This is not like a DraftKings or FanDuel, where consumers are getting ripped off, they're getting taken advantage of. And so, you know, legalizing sports wagering in Missouri also makes sure that you're protecting consumers.
I will provide just a brief fact check, but only because I've covered this a lot. Oklahoma still does not have sports betting, but otherwise your point stands.
Yeah.
Surrounding states.
Yeah.
And I've talked to numerous people who drive over to Illinois on the St. Louis side that place a bet on the Cardinals or the Blues or whoever they want to bet on. But, you know, do you see any path forward on this issue this year in the legislature?
This session seems unlikely. You know, I've got at least one of my Senate colleagues who's, you know, very passionate about the video lottery terminal expansion. I think we got a pretty clear answer on that last session. There was an amendment that was offered on the floor to my sports wagering bill that had a roll call vote on it. It went down. It wasn't a particularly close vote. So I think the will of the Senate is to, you know, pass a clean sports wagering bill, but not to attach to it any of this expansion or legalization of video lottery terminals.
You know, it's no secret that Senator Denny Hoskins is more or less the face of those terminals. He's wanting to combine the issue of sports betting and VLTs into one bill. Is it a matter of waiting him out, or do you think someone else will take up the mantle once he's termed out?
You know, I think that there are certainly people, you know, from last session that we saw when that vote happened on the VLT amendment. There are some people that are supportive of VLT expansion. My belief is, and I could be proven wrong on this next session, but my belief is the people who are supportive of that will want to try to attach it to the bill, but they're not going to go the next further step, which is if they cannot attach a VLT amendment to a clean sports wagering bill, they won't stand up and kill the underlying legislation. And that's the difference in where we are right now. So, you know, I remain optimistic that if we, you know, come back next session and we have a new Senate or a different looking Senate than we do right now, that we can pass a clean sports wagering bill.
Well, right now there is an effort on behalf of the sports teams to legalize sports betting through the Constitution, through the initiative petition process. What are your thoughts on that? Do you think that maybe they needed to wait just like one more year? Or do you think this is, you know, it's seen so many years that it haven't get done that you understand where they're coming from?
No, I understand where they're coming from. And I've had conversations with some of the owners of some of our professional sports franchises in Missouri. I understand, you know, their position on this. The ballot measure that they propose has some small modifications relative to what my bill looks like, but it largely tracks what my legislation does. And so, you know, if they want to go the initiative petition route to try to get it done because they're not able to get something through the General Assembly, I mean, I suppose I don't have any issues with that.
Do you think that would get a lot of support from people? Because, you know, widely enough, gambling is something that, you know, I have friends who are, you know, they did a lot of driving over, but there's some people that we know that don't support it. It's definitely not like a either or. It's definitely not an either or situation. So what are your thoughts of like the public perception of that?
Yeah, I don't know that it's like it's one of those 80% like slam dunks that is going to pass. I think it's probably closer to a 50-50 proposition. So, you know, if it were something that were to get on the ballot, its passage or failure is probably going to have more to do with how much money is spent on advocacy for the ballot measure on each side. Because all else being equal, I think it probably passes if there's no opposition campaign. But if there is a stringent opposition campaign, then there's a real risk of it failing.
Speaking of the initiative petition process, Senate Democrats effectively shut down work Wednesday due to Senator Mary Elizabeth Coleman on Tuesday mentioning the option of bringing forth a previous question motion, which for our listeners is basically a motion to end debate, which is not common at all in the Senate. It's more common in the House. Democrats said that was totally out of line of her to say that to the House committee. What do you make of this situation?
Well, let me just say this. I think there are conversations, it seems like every session, over whether the majority would exercise a PQ to cut off debate to move a priority issue forward. Typically, those conversations happen behind closed doors. They happen in leadership meetings or caucus meetings. It's a little less conventional to have that threat be made in a public hearing, which is, I think, what makes this a little bit different. We didn't get to any legislative business yesterday because of that. And we'll see if that has any hangover effect that's still lingering around whenever we get back from spring break.
What would you like to see on a final version of any resolution that would make it harder to amend Missouri's constitution if it does pass both chambers and goes to the public for a vote?
So I do like the concurrent congressional majority solution that we came up with, which for the benefit of your listeners right now, to amend the Missouri constitution, it takes a simple majority vote to amend it. So anything over 50% amends the constitution. What this would do is say, not only do you have to have 50 plus one, you also have to have a majority of Missouri's 8 congressional districts. So 5 of the 8 congressional districts would have to also independently pass the ballot measure. And the reason behind that is it makes sure that there's a broad-based consensus across the state if we're going to amend the Constitution, because you can't go in and just win an election by campaigning in St. Louis or Kansas City. You got to bring in rural Missouri. Conversely, you probably can't win an election just by looking to rural Missouri and then completely ignoring our 2 major metropolitan areas. And so, you know, my view on this is that the Constitution is a fundamental governing document. That's the purpose of a constitution, is to set the basic framework of government to secure the basic rights and liberties of the people. What the Missouri Constitution has turned into over the years, because it is so breathtakingly easy to amend it, is it turned really into an ever-growing special interest statute. And what we will see is different interest groups who will come in who can't get a bill through the General Assembly for various reasons, and they will just circumvent the normal legislative process and then just effectively put into the Constitution what should be a statute. If you look at the Missouri Constitution, I always joke that it's like the length of the yellow pages in a phone book. I mean, it's very lengthy. And you contrast that with the U.S. Constitution, the United States Constitution, which is relatively difficult to amend, has only been amended 17 times if you exclude the original Bill of Rights. Two of those amendments were prohibition and then the repeal of prohibition. So practically speaking, in the 250-year history of our country, we've only amended the United States Constitution 15 times. I think that's a good thing, because the Constitution occupies a different space than a mere statute does. It's there really to, as I said before, set up the basic fundamental structure of government and then to protect basic rights and liberties of the people.
You know, my question to you, and I've asked this to pretty much every Republican when I talk about this process, is how do you sell this to voters, that this is something that's in their interest? Because I think a lot of voters are going to say, hey, I want medical marijuana. I want a minimum wage increase. Jefferson City isn't doing anything about it. And this is a way that I can get things that I'm interested in. So how do you sell that to people that, oh, no, this is a process that ultimately would be difficult to do that? I'm curious, like, your argument for that.
Yeah, so I think my argument would be twofold. One, you don't want the Constitution, which again secures basic rights and liberties of the people, and sets up the basic framework and structure of government, to be so easy to amend that it could have a destabilizing effect on government. Like, you don't want that to have happen. I don't think anybody would want that to happen. And that's why constitutions are typically harder to amend. The second thing I would say is, voters still have the ability, if the General Assembly doesn't act on something, to put something into state law. They do it through a proposition. So that's different than a constitutional amendment. But minimum wage, for example, the last time that there was a minimum wage measure on the ballot, it actually wasn't a constitutional amendment. It was a proposition. And so propositions have the effect of state law. And so if you don't think the General Assembly is acting, then pass a statute and then put it in the statute books without us. We don't need to amend the Constitution, though, to do that.
I think some of the concern of that is that the legislature can go right back in and basically undo what people voted for. So would you maybe be in support of bolstering statutory changes, or kind of like thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, we could certainly have conversations around that. I guess my perspective would be, if you look at recent history, every proposition that is passed in Missouri, at least since I've been in elective office, and even for at least a decade before that, I don't think there's ever been an instance of the General Assembly undoing what voters have done in proposition.
So today, the Senate passed a huge omnibus bill on education. What are your thoughts on that bill? How do you feel like it will change Missouri's education system?
Yeah, well, I mean, if we can, I mean, I kind of like to talk about just kind of the contents of the legislation, or at least some of the bigger items that are in there. You know, the first is, we made some changes to the state foundation formula, which is the basis for calculating how much money schools receive from the state of Missouri. The net effect of those changes long term is going to be to increase the amount of state funding that goes to schools by about $300 million a year. So that's a significant change. It also had a provision in there that modified the existing educational savings account statute, which allows people who are low income to receive educational scholarships to be able to go to private school, or to be able to use it for homeschooling or virtual education if, for whatever reason, they live in a failing district and they don't have the normal educational opportunities K-12, they can take advantage of those. And so it increases the cap for eligibility for ESAs to every school district in the state. Before, it was limited to only certain school districts. Now, anybody in any school in the state of Missouri would be able to apply for one of these ESA scholarships. And then in addition to that, it raised the cap, the overall amount of ESAs that could be awarded in a given year. It was $50 million. We raised it by another $25 million to $75 million. We had a provision in there that raised starting teacher pay. Missouri ranks among the bottom for starting teacher pay in the country. And what the bill that we passed today would do is, over the course of a three-year period, it would almost double starting teacher pay. Right now, an entry-level teacher minimum compensation is $25,000. Over the next 3 years, we'll move up to $48,000. And then the legislation has an inflator in it, so that way it will keep up with inflation so that we don't have to keep coming back and revising the statute. I think that's a really good thing. That was one of the things I was, you know, very supportive of in the bill, because We do need to recruit and retain top teachers. And when you're ranking near the bottom of the other 50 states in teacher pay, that's not where you want to be. And then the last thing I guess I would mention that was in the bill that I thought was important is the issue of 4-day school weeks. We've started to see school districts around the state start to move away from the traditional Monday through Friday 5-day school week and go back to a 4-day school week. You know, I think that just places such a huge burden on working families when you have a mom and a dad who are both working outside of the home. You know, to say that, you know, kids aren't going to be in school or Monday or Friday, that's just really tough for people. I also think one of the things that we learned from COVID is that most kids do a much better job learning when they're in a classroom environment, and that kids struggle oftentimes in a remote environment. And so I think that, you know, we want to encourage, you know, a 5-day school week. And so what we did is for larger school districts, the only way that you can have a 4-day school week is you have to have a local vote. So there's basically the presumption that you're going to have a 5-day school week. And unless you can convince local voters to go the other way, it's a 5-day school week. On some of the smaller counties, you know, some of my colleagues had concerns over that with their school districts. I frankly would have preferred that it apply statewide, but we put some economic incentives in there where you receive additional money under the foundation formula if you have a 5-day school week, which should hopefully encourage, you know, all the schools in the state to keep with a 5-day school week.
I also want to add that there's also the implementation of charter schools just in Boone County, but there's a lot in here. And originally it started out as just an ESA expansion and the expansion of charter schools. St. Charles and St. Louis counties were in there. That got stripped out. But what are your thoughts that it's kind of become really a bipartisan education package? I know Democrats didn't vote for it, but I know that two of them at least voted yes on the perfection and adding those additions. I think there's a lot that everyone can, no one loves it, but I think everyone, there's a lot of people like about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, the reality is, unless Senator Koenig, who's the sponsor of the underlying bill, unless he was willing to compromise and try to bring different elements in support of the legislation, there was no way to get an education reform bill through the Senate realistically absent a PQ. And the way that you do it without a PQ is through, you know, compromise and negotiation. And so there's a lot of provisions that Senator Koenig put in that bill that weren't in his original bill. Frankly, probably some of them he would have preferred not see in the final bill. But that's the art of negotiating in the Senate. You've got to be willing to, you know, work with different folks and to be able to get a package that you can put together and to be able to get it across the finish line. And, you know, it was unfortunately just a straight line partisan vote. It was just Republicans voting in favor of the bill. But nevertheless, we were able to get some good educational reform done and provide more choice to students and to their parents.
And speaking of the Senate, to zoom out a little bit, how do you feel like session has gone so far?
It's been an interesting session. You know, when we started session, I had a bunch of people coming by the office asking me to, you know, prognosticate on what I thought the session was going to look like. And I said, well, I think we'll probably pass a budget and renew the FRA. And beyond that, I'm not sure we'll pass any substantive legislation. Now, I'm happy to report that at the midpoint of the session, I've been proven wrong. We've sent, you know, close to a dozen bills over to the House. That's certainly a much slower start than we would expect in a normal legislative session. But given the low-level expectations that I had coming into this year, you know, I would say that the Senate's actually been, frankly, more productive than I thought we were going to be.
But we're also not yet at a budget or an FRA. Do you see those as particularly heavy lifts the second half of the session?
You know, look, the only constitutional obligation the General Assembly has is to pass a balanced budget. That's it. You know, all the substantive legislation that we talked about before up until this point in the interview, those are all optional. You know, those are all things that we would like to do whenever we come down to Jefferson City. You know, we'd like to make some statutory changes. The only thing we have to do is pass a balanced budget. And so I'm confident that we will find a way to do that. What that looks like whenever we get back from spring break, I don't even know. But I'm confident that we will find a path forward on the budget.
Well, thank you so much, Senator, for joining us on Politically Speaking. Politically Speaking is a product of St. Louis Public Radio, which is a part of the University of Missouri-St. Louis. You can follow all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And Senator Lueckemeyer, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Yeah, you can follow me on Twitter, @Tony4Missouri. And that's the same handle I use on all of my social media. So whether it's Instagram or Facebook, that's the place to find me.
All right, until next time, so long.